Category E3, news broadcaster, Chris Donoghue.
Because in September this year, an article appeared in the Irish Times from an unknown contributor known as Grace Ringwood. Now, Grace's piece was a very moving description of her personal struggle with depression and the issue of suicide. It later transpired that Grace's real name was Kate, and between writing the piece in August and the article being printed in early September, Kate took her own life. On Saturday of this week, the Irish Times published more in-depth details of the story written by Peter Murta, in which Kate's parents contributed to that story. Now, many people listening to this will know how far and wide that this story has travelled in the last 3 or 4 days. The broadsheet.ie website has been covering it in depth. The last time I checked, there were about 10,000 times on Facebook that this story had been shared, and thousands of times on Twitter as well. But last night I spoke with Sally Ann, who is Kate's mother, Sally Ann Fitzgerald. And I told her that I had read the story in the Irish Times. I found it extremely moving. I told her I had read all of the things online, and I indeed had read Kate's own piece. But I wanted to start the interview by her telling me about Kate.
Kate, I don't even know where to start. She was such a wonderful girl. Kate was very bright. She was very talented. She was a great writer, and I did not know it, but she was a great singer. I have a singing school, and I gave her a few lessons last summer. It was the first time I'd ever heard her sing, because my children always wanted to stay away from that side. They just thought that was mom's area, and I didn't know that both of them actually can sing so well. So she sang beautifully at a wedding just about 2 months before she died. Kate had tremendous ambition. She had great determination. She was a great friend to many, and a great advisor, a great helper, a mentor to people that were in DCU, where she was an alumnus. And she was a wonderful daughter and a great sister to her brother, William. She had fought depression, we think, for a few years, but it was not the type that you would categorize as, you know, having to be hospitalized or something like that. We tried different methods and brought her to different doctors who had tried to help her in different ways. I've got a history of depression in my family, so we tried that, but we didn't realize the seriousness of the situation. She really kept it to herself.
And Sally Ann, you and your husband spoke about Kate in the article in the Irish Times on Saturday, and you described somebody who was extremely ambitious. And I'm a couple of years older than Kate, and I just reading it, just in what jumped out of the page for me was the feeling of not being able to wait to be grown up, to be big in the world.
That's right. Yeah. Kate, it was a little different. And there's a paradox there. She was, on one hand, we thought that she wanted to get out there and be a tiger and just go for it. And then on the other, she just was never really comfortable with being an adult, I don't think. She wanted to be independent, and at the same time, she wanted to stay a little girl. That's all I can describe it as. It's a very unusual thing. And we thought she was very tough. She had been bullied in secondary school, and we thought that she could handle most anything that came her way. And unfortunately, we were wrong.
And Sally Ann, you told us that you and your family were aware of Kate's depression. How did that manifest itself? When and how did you go about dealing with it?
Right. Well, she would tell us when she left secondary school, it would be in college that she first had the first symptoms. And because she was well aware of what had happened to me with my history of depression, my brother had committed suicide in 2002. I have a half-sister who committed suicide in 1985. And she knew that there was a great family history of this. So we were all very up on it. My sisters would give advice. I would give advice. I would want her to do things like, I don't know if your listeners are aware of cognitive behavioral therapy, but that's the kind of thing I wanted her to do, to try and reframe the negative thinking that comes with depression, because it's a chemical imbalance, it's a physical illness, and if you get on the right antidepressants, have the right doctor's care, if he diagnoses it correctly, and then you also have this kind of reframing of your thinking, you can really go on to be, you know, successfully try to rid yourself of this terrible disease.
And Sally Ann, in the piece that Kate sent to the Irish Times, I have to put my hands up here because in reading it, I confronted myself because I was wondering, you know, when somebody in work, say, comes back from, for example, a heart attack or something, you ask them, you know, if they're okay. If somebody suffers a bereavement in your friends or in work, again, you know a manner of going about dealing with that. But when it comes to mental illness and when it comes to depression, I don't know what to do. And many people, if they're honest, don't know what to do.
That's exactly right. I think that, and that's why I have a problem with the term mental illness, actually, Chris, because I think that what happens is that people out there do not understand that this is something that's a physical ailment as well. It's a psychological ailment, of course, but there's a physical chemical imbalance going on. So therefore, it's not put in the same category as, say, cancer or heart disease or something like that. So they do not treat it as something that is a physical disease, and therefore the person feels shamed. Now, if they feel shame, this is only going to compound their misery, compound their desperation. And that's why it's such a vicious circle, because if people did look at it as a physical problem, then perhaps they would understand and treat people more kindly and more humanely.
And for people, do you think it's the quandary of, you know, press on, pretend that the person hasn't been missing for a month and just press on like it's a normal day? Or do you actually stop? Do you seek them out and say, are you okay? Do you need anything?
Yes, I think that is something that is missing in many workplaces. And I think with friends as well, I think that a lot of people get fed up. They don't know how to deal with it, and they wash their hands of the person. And what the person really needs is constant support and love. And that's what we tried to do for Kate. I think that sometimes if a person seems very tough and they can handle it and you should just get on with it, that's the sort of attitude that prevails, then that's just going to make the problem worse because they will think they have no support structure.
And Sally Ann, Kate's words, which she left and which she sent to the Irish Times and which she sent to Peter Murta, those words to me are somebody who is pouring her heart out onto a page. And anyone who read this, and so many people have read this, and the reason they've passed it around is because she is pouring her heart out onto a page about all of this.
That's right. That's right. She actually was. And those were what served to be her final words. They were very important, and they were heartbreaking to read. If people out there, your listeners, think it was hard for them, just imagine what it was like for our family. We were completely blindsided by this tragedy, and I don't think we'll ever be able to get over it.
And I know everyone is analysing what those words meant. To me, I see positivity. I see somebody who was working their way through this. And was that the impression you had of Kate?
Yes, it was. It was, Chris. I spoke to her, in fact, on the night that she died. We're not sure exactly of the time. Her brother also spoke to her. She spoke to Peter Murta, as you know, and to everyone, and including the person for whom she was working. No one had picked up any signs that she had a plan. And that is the God-honest truth. If we had picked it up, we certainly would have taken action. We had no idea.
And just finally, Sally Ann, yourself and your husband and Kate's brother, who you've spoken about a couple of times in this interview, you are aware of how far and wide Kate's words have been passed and how far and wide this story has reached. And it's in a week where it's very relevant and people are thinking and talking about suicide. What do you hope comes of all of this? What do you hope the legacy of this letter is?
Let's try to erase the stigma that surrounds suicide and depression in general. Let's treat it as what it is, and that is a physical ailment. And try to be supportive of people. Be kind to each other. Be kind to the people that you love. Be there for them. And if you're in a workplace, support them through it so that they will have someone to go to if they need help and that a tragedy like this can be avoided. If people were talking about the subject more, which is what we would like to do, bring it to the forefront, then I think that this would not be so pervasive. It happens in my own country, and it happens here. And on the very day that Kate died, there was another boy in our town who also committed suicide. And it has completely galvanized this community and really got people talking about the issue, which is what we would like to be Kate's legacy. That's something that's very important to us because we don't want her to have died in vain. So if we can bring a positive out of this very negative situation, then that's something.
That was Sally Ann Fitzgerald. The big statements, if you like, so far from the TUI: if you touch the Teachers Union of Ireland, if you touch our salary, which includes allowances, all bets are off. And the big statement from Minister Quinn: some people don't understand the gravity of the crisis Ireland's in. Let's have a listen to how he got on.
Teachers are, I'm very glad to say, generally enthusiastic about the proposed changes. Let me offer you some evidence of that. The NCCA was looking for 40 schools, and instead of getting 40 schools, we got 120 applicants.
I think it's gas when you hear teachers acting up in a classroom. See, imagine if the schools did that next week. You'd be detention for everyone.
I'm not knocking teachers. It lets them all down.
Okay, well, education accounts for 17% of government spending in Ireland, 8.6 billion this year. The average pay of an Irish teacher is 55 to 60,000 euro at the moment, the highest in the OECD. I spoke to Minister Quinn a few minutes ago, and I started by putting it to him that he'd been mauled by two unions in one day.
No, I wasn't. The unions have a list of concerns, which I respect. I tried to address the context in which those concerns have to be resolved, including the macroeconomic situation. And I got mixed reactions to some of the comments that I made.
One of the comments you made was that the gravity of the crisis isn't understood by some. Who are the some? Are you talking to the teachers there?
Well, I'm talking to anybody, but specifically since I'm Minister for Education and Skills and I was at a teachers' conference, obviously I was addressing them directly. But there are some people who feel that we can simply say, no, we're not going to have any more cuts. We have a budget deficit, a gap of 18,000 million between what we spend and what we take in by way of taxes. Now, austerity on its own is not the solution, but unless we get a combination of reduction in expenditure and an increase in economic growth, including jobs and extra taxes, we're not going to be able to close that gap. And irrespective of whether we were in a programme with the Troika, no country can run a deficit indefinitely. And we'll have to get to that point. I would much prefer if we had economic growth that showed increases in employment. But for so long as the European crisis is there and confidence in the euro worldwide is weak, we're going to be in the difficult situation we are at the moment. And that's why the stability mechanism is so important.
So there will be more cuts in education. 8.6 million, billion, the budget at the moment, 17% of government spending. There will be more cuts.
Yes, there will be.
Will there be more cuts in teacher salaries?
The Croke Park Agreement, which is working and which has delivered industrial peace and productivity, is an agreement between the government and the social partners. It has a fixed term, and as far as I'm concerned, the government have no plans to change the terms of the Croke Park Agreement. What we do want, of course, is to maximise the productivity which it is delivering.
OK, so for example, when the PTR, the pupil-teacher ratio, went up by one. I was having a look through the budget last night. I think that saved you about 18 million or something like that. So are you saying that that is how you're going to approach education going forward again?
First of all, you get a one-third saving in the first year in which you introduce any change with the PTR, because you're basically dealing from September to the end of that calendar year, and then you get the balance of the saving in the subsequent year when you run from effectively January through to the end of June. I'm not saying anything at the moment, Chris, because you and I are not negotiating next year's budget.
OK, well, let's negotiate allowances. Teachers seemed to say yesterday in the conferences that their allowances are different to, for example, other allowances in the public service, that their allowances are basically, and they consider it, part of their core pay. Do you agree, because you've said their pay will be protected as per Croke Park, does that include what I think is 500 million in allowances?
Well, does a teacher's pay scale, starting from the bottom scale and moving up, when you get promoted within the school system to become a deputy principal or a post of management in the system, you get an allowance for that particular extra set of duties that you undertake. You don't change your grade as you do in the civil service, moving, we say, from an executive officer up to a higher executive officer and up to a principal and so on, with a consequent increase in your actual salary. So the words are misleading. In some parts of the public service, allowances are special additions of money on top of your pay and pension entitlements. In the teaching profession, and this is a legacy of history, the basic teacher's scale is maintained, and added to it as a salary is an allowance, called an allowance, which is quite misleading for the ordinary general public. And that allowance is not only a part of the salary of the teacher in question, like a principal in a primary school, but also is considered and reckoned for their pension as well.
So do I take from that that they're protected, as per your other statement about Croke Park?
Well, that's the interpretation that has been put on it by the advice that I have received, that this would be to unilaterally change the allowances would be seen by many people, and this was conveyed to me very clearly yesterday, as a breach of Croke Park. Okay.
But Minister, you see, when you say to, when you stand in front of a conference of teachers and say that they don't understand the gravity of the situation, and then Croke Park seems utterly protected, and critics of the government's approach says it's in fact the cabinet that doesn't understand the gravity of the situation. We can't afford it.
Well,
look, it is 7:45. Front page of today's Irish Examiner has a picture of a family of 10, a beautiful family, in fact, 8 children. They're pictured, Jason and Vicky Casey, and their 8 children aged 11 down to 8 months. But the headline with the story is, we want more babies but need a bigger council house. And on the line now to tell us more is the man pictured in that picture with his family, Jason Casey from Glenbrook in Limerick. Good morning, Jason.
Good morning.
Jason, nice to speak to you. First of all, you have your hands full. 8 children aged 11 down to 8 months.
Yeah, it's kind of a funny time to be calling me now to tell you the truth. We're very busy this time of the morning.
Getting them out to school and all that.
Yeah, we have, yeah.
Now, Jason, tell me this. I've read the story, obviously, this morning on the front of the Examiner. You're out of work. How long have you been out of work?
A couple of years now.
You were trying to get a business off the ground yourself, a food business.
Yes, I was in the building business. I was in... We'll start from the beginning away. I got exported to England when I was 14, and I met Vicky over in England, and we had 2 children, and we decided to come home. So I got into the building business when I came home, and then the building business kind of went bust on us. We thought it was going to last forever, so I started up my own little business, and the amount of red tape and the amount of stuff I had to go through to get it up and running was frightening. But I got it up and running. But then I wasn't being issued a license by the council.
You were selling hot dogs, weren't you? It was a food business. You were selling hot dogs on the streets, basically.
Yes.
And what? You just kept getting moved on, or you weren't allowed? You were allowed to sell in the morning, but not at night time when the pubs and clubs and all that were emptying out.
Well, yes. I had two. They issue certain licenses in Limerick, and one of them is for special events, which would be Poma Park, the Gaelic Grounds. And the other one then is for the Saturday market. Now, unfortunately, I wasn't making enough of money at them, so I was out trading at night time. But there isn't the license to trade at night time.
Okay.
So the Gardaí kept moving me on.
Jason, the story today says that you've been 10 years on a housing waiting list and you want more babies, the headline says, but the council won't give you a bigger house.
Well, I do want more babies. We will be having more babies, God willing. But that wasn't my problem. The problem here is that when I came back from England, I put my name on the housing list and was told within 5 years I'd have a house in the area that I wanted. So then my 5 years came up, and at that point I had 5 kids, and they said, no, there's nothing available. So I went through the appeals process and sent them letters, and they sent me letters back, and that went on for a while. And then I thought, maybe there's something on my file. They're not going to give me a house. So I asked my file under the Freedom of Information Act, which the majority of it was blacked out, so I wasn't happy with that. So then I took them to the ombudsman. He only got the same file I got, which was like nothing really in it. So he said there was nothing to do with it. And then I went to see the Minister for Housing, and I got no idea.
Jason, what do you say to people who are hopping mad listening to you and saying, stop having babies if you can't afford at the moment?
No, you can't. In today's economy, you can't afford 1 or 2. But like, everyone will manage, and we will manage. And I love the bones of all of my kids. And me and my wife love having kids.
Well, what about the fact that at the moment, I mean, you're out of work, you're in a council house, the figures are struggling, and you're living off a council house, and maybe you need to stop and stand on your own 2 feet?
But I am willing to stand on my own 2 feet. I don't want to be in receipt of benefits. I did go out and try to walk, and I wasn't being given a license to walk. I mean, I don't want my kids to see me begging off of the state. I want my kids to see me coming home at 5 or 6 o'clock and saying, what did you do today, and walk, Daddy. I want them to see that the way to go isn't the dole, and the way to go isn't to be begging off of the state. The state should be there behind families helping them to get off the dole, helping them to get proper accommodation.
Okay, now, so you're available for work?
I am available for work, yes.
If somebody was listening to you, look, here's a fella who's saying the right things, he has a family of eight, I'd be willing to give him a chance. Would you take a job?
Not a problem. I would love to.
And have you been for interviews and all of that?
I've been sending off CVs and stuff, but there isn't a lot out there. There's a lot more educated people out there than me and a lot more experienced people out there than me, and they're still finding it a struggle to get work.
If somebody was in touch with us to say, look, I'm in Limerick, I'll give this fella a chance, would you take it?
I would.
Okay. Well, look, Jason, we'll...
News Talk 106 to 108.